Hi everyone and welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast. I'm your host and co-founder, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Damon Shaw. How are you, Damon?
I'm not too bad, thanks, Laurie. Good. Thanks for having us on.
No worries at all. Can you just tell the listeners a wee bit of background about yourself?
So, sorry, I should have asked you this before. What's the target audience that you've got on your podcast? Is it football coaches or futsal or something totally different?
Futsal, football, everyone. It's great. We've interviewed technical directors. I think we've interviewed squash players and all that. So everyone's interested, but it's all about the kind of the mindset of a coach. So it's always good to kind of get that. So can you just tell us a wee bit of background about yourself and we can chat from there?
Yeah, perfect. So I'm a futsal coach, one of only two with the UEFA license, English coaches that is, because the actual coaching course doesn't exist yet in England. So there's myself and a lad called Jeremy, who followed me to Barcelona. So we did our UEFA in Spain. There's only UEFA Pro above that, so that's my next step. So yeah, I'm an English futsal coach, currently working in Malaysia. I say working, we've all been affected by the lockdown, so I'm currently just waiting for things to clear up a bit. And I've passed through Malta, Spain, England. I've worked a bit in Scotland with Perth Youth Futsal. Ever since I got involved in futsal, I've just decided, right, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to set, where I want to sort of aim my life. I want to dedicate my life to this sport because it's something that I found, something that I was passionate about, something where I saw a lot of opportunities for myself, but also to, you know, grow communities. And I started off at Teesside Junior. I think we'll get onto that in a second, but
yeah.
Started off there and I thought, you know, I was at university. It was a nice way to bring people together, to do something a bit different. Slightly different setting to the football team, which was football team at uni tending to be a lot of the, for want of a better word, the popular guys that, yeah, you know, joined that club. Quite a big drinking culture. You know, we were all at uni, so we all enjoyed a night out. But I think it had a different sort of feeling to the football club, and it was maybe a bit more inclusive in that sense. So, you know, I'm not a football person. Apart from a fan, and I love watching and playing all sorts of football, but I think when I set up the futsal club, it was maybe something a little bit different for the people, and we had people that probably wouldn't have got involved in football at university joining the futsal club, which was quite nice. And aside from loving the sport, I really enjoyed creating this community, creating this culture. I did that up in Middlesbrough Teesside. I've done that as well at Tranmere. And for me, building the club, building the structure, giving opportunities to people, children that might not necessarily be into football or might want a different pathway, might prefer it. So it, for me, it's another option. It's a valid option for a kid to start their sort of their football journey. So yeah, that's where my sort of passion and dedication for futsal came from initially.
Yeah, because when I was doing my research, you started at 21, you know, quite young, but as you said, you kind of went through that university, you know, and tried to, you might not be a football coach, but you're a futsal coach, you want to try something new. And when you were at kind of Teesside University and working with Middlesbrough kind of futsal, you won, you know, 3 British championships, which is a really incredible record. Uh-huh. Two semi-finals and 1 trophy in the 6 years. Can you tell us how you built that? You know, because futsal is something that's still a wee bit new to a lot of people, but being a coach is something, it takes a skill, but also building a club takes another skill. I'm just wondering how you built that success, you know, at such a young age.
Oh, very good question. So when I first got involved in it, I wasn't a football coach. I didn't have a coaching background. I was quite a good organiser. That's probably disappeared from my skill set these days. But I've always prided myself on being able to organise something. And before futsal, I was organising five-a-side tournaments with my friends back in Clitheroe, where I'm from, where I went to school. And that led me to initiate something at the university. And then after a few games, I realised I wasn't that good a player. So I thought, right, I'm going to coach. I think it was a third game in a tournament. I was like, right, I'm going to coach the third game. I'm going to get off the pitch because I'm not good enough. And I'll start coaching. So I had this opportunity to start coaching. And because there was no one else, I just kind of fell into it. And I loved it. I knew nothing about the sport at this point. I knew very little about tactics, very little about how to coach people. What I did know how to do was organise the journey, the structure, the travel, you know, all that sort of things. And that sort of brought together a lot of people, and I created a nice little community at the university. So I think the success came on the back of having that togetherness. We had some quality players as well. We attracted quite a few future England internationals in the first year at Teesside University. We had one player that, for me, is still the best English futsal player I've ever seen, Ben Everson. Fortunately for him, he's had a football career. So we had some very good players in that first year. And also, not downplaying the achievement, but that first year, as I've said, I liked organising stuff. The tournament was organised by myself. I'm not saying I fixed it,
yeah.
But it was quite a small. It was quite a small event without a lot of reach. I mean, we had regional qualifiers all over the UK. It was a pilot event for Bucks, then called Boosa, to hopefully take futsal on, which they have done, and now it's the biggest sport or the biggest futsal competition in the UK.
Yeah.
So the first one was quite easy to win in terms of everyone else was very, very inexperienced. We were, but we were lucky that we had some good players. But we created this really good, culture community at the Teesside University, and people loved the playing. It was a new sport. It was a project, and that first year was brilliant. And then it grew. The sport grew. So we then started coming up against teams like Loughborough and Bath and Hartbury. And I couldn't tell you how we got the success. We had great players. We were lucky that we had some really good players come to Teesside University that have gone on to have really good futsal careers. The likes of Ben Mortlock, who was our captain, went on to play for England. Jason Kilbride's an England international. There was a lot of good players in that group. And I think it just grew into some sort of, we were an underfunded university, small university side, we didn't even have tracksuits for the most part. We had to borrow kit off football teams, things like that. So we were like the underdogs. We were up against it again. And then we came up against Team Bath, Loughborough, Hartbury, these massively funded sports universities. And I think the sort of the gritty Middlesbrough culture, the gritty attitude of the North East sort of came through, and really, you know, sort of a David versus Goliath thing. And that carried on all the way through all the 6 years. And that gives me faith that given enough time in another project, I can build something similar. So, I think it was just... how can I put this? Trying to make the players feel like they were special, they were superstars, they were this big thing at this little small club, and that gave them the desire to go on and win. Looking back at my coaching, I can't really take any credit for the coaching, but
always need to.
No, I mean that's probably had some effect on it, but
And see that you talked about the kind of Middlesbrough kind of thing. You won the futsal league and the FA kind of futsal league in 2009, but you had the red faction. Can you tell us how that felt? You know, see all the fans and all that in that kind of wave, because it's obviously getting more professional as we kind of get on to things. But I'm just wondering, you know, winning that with Middlesbrough, you know, a pro team, and then having that kind of red faction, you know, it must be a really great eye-opener to see that futsal is starting to, you know, progress into the kind of professional leagues.
Yeah, so back in 2009, we, again, this was on the back of the solid, like the good players we had at Teesside University. We had a great group of young players coming through there. Most of them were the same players for Middlesbrough. Obviously, Middlesbrough being a mainstream club, we could bring in other players. So there weren't many, to be honest. We didn't have many players that weren't students. We had one or two. We had a couple of foreign players come over. And again, 2009 was a special year, mostly students again that year. I don't think we had much foreign influence, but that year was, again, it was a special year. And I think the same attitude and the same feeling we had for Teesside crossed over into that. Like I said, it was the same team. Only the name was different. One for the National League, one for the university competition. And I remember one game we played Loughborough. And Loughborough turned up with 14 players, 8 coaches, you know, all the tracksuits, everything, a well-funded club. And that was a day we had 17 players unavailable through injury. Oof. out of you know, a big university squad. And we travelled down to that game with 6.5 players, me as the only technical staff. I think we had a couple of new players, and we did a bit of training before the match started. And we won that game. I think it was 7-5 we won. And, you know, moments like that really give sort of power to the underdogs. And that season we went on and we beat Loughborough in the final game to clinch the title. And yeah, doing it for Middlesbrough was different to doing it for Teesside Uni. At Teesside Uni, you can't really get the buy-in from the local town.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's, even in football, I don't think it's heard of where the university team has a big support outside of the students. So my dream was to build a community, build a club that the town could be proud of. And it was just a natural progression from Teesside Uni. So obviously all along, I wanted to have the community, so the fans coming along to games. And it wasn't until about 2010, it was after we'd won that league that we started to get a bit of interest from the fans, and that just came about by contacting the fan groups and saying, look, we'd love your support. And you know, they started coming. We had one game where we were playing Sheffield at home, and it was so unexpected that they were going to turn up. No, that's totally not true. Actually, it was Manchester away. They turned up out of the blue. We had no idea they were going to come. And there's only about 10 of them came away to Manchester to watch this small team play in this unheard of sport, you know, in an amateur league. It was surreal, to be honest. And then the next game was at home, and they brought a big amount of fans. They brought all the banners, toilet rolls. It was brilliant. Okay. And you know, that atmosphere that they created then spurred us up, because we were 6-2 down with 8 minutes to go. And I don't know if you know the story of Middlesbrough in the UEFA Cup, but they had 2 matches in the quarters and the semis where they needed 4 goals to win.
Yeah, I think they were playing.
I remember it.
Was it Juventus they had to play, or am I getting that wrong?
Oh,
I can't remember. Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Stoia Bucharest was one. And anyway, so we had this timeout with, I think, 8 minutes on the clock. 6-2 down to Sheffield, who were the favourites, the champions, or whatever they were at that point. And the fans would have been amazing all the game we're losing. They unfurled this massive banner, one of the, what did they call it? One of the floaters, or.
Yeah.
Anyway, massive. And it said Spirit of Stoia on it. And obviously, we needed 5 goals to win the game. And then in the next 4 minutes, we were 7-6 up. And. Yeah, that moment was just unbelievable. We'd got to a point where we'd attracted fans, we'd built this club, we had a really good community, a really good family feel. And then just for that to happen, and then to spur us on, and they were massive to the club. That made everything sort of more worthwhile as well. You're not just doing it for you anymore, you're doing it for people's happiness, you're doing it for the town, you're doing it for, you know, people that are going out of the way to go and watch you. So that changed everything when the fans started coming. And unfortunately, we've not really seen anything since where we've had, you know, that sort of culture at futsal games. There's been matches with lots of crowds now in England, but I don't think without, you know, I don't know all the instances, but that's something that definitely needs to come into the game. And you know, it'll change the landscape if fans do start coming.
Yeah,
in the numbers,
definitely. And through that, obviously, Middlesbrough, you got a move to Spain. Can you tell us why, and also what did you achieve there? Because moving to a different country, you need to learn the language, you need to learn the skills and all that. But when you've won, you know, a few championships, you're kind of in the kind of shop window. I'm just wondering, you could tell us a wee bit about the kind of the Spain adventure.
I wouldn't say I was in the shop window. In terms of English futsal, it was unheard of in Spain. By the way, are you hearing everything correctly? Just because you seem to be breaking up a bit for me, but okay, good. So I wasn't headhunted as such. People weren't looking at me thinking, "Oh, this guy's winning tournaments. Let's hire him as a coach." No, it was through a connection that I'd made at FC Barcelona. And the guy, he was one of the players at the time, Fernando. He'd just taken over the running of a village club, town club, near Barcelona. And he had this idea to have an English coach to do some coaching in English with the academy, just to give his club a bit more of a selling point. So he's like, "Look, we'll bring you over. We'll pay you." It wasn't much. It was €100 a month plus accommodation.
Yeah.
I was working on something else at the time. I was organising some tours for Australian teams. So, you know, I had enough money to live. I had enough money to get by, so my accommodation and food was sorted. So, yeah, it was a crossroads for me because we'd taken Middlesbrough to be one of the teams that was going to challenge every year in England.
Yeah.
And it could have carried on a nice trajectory, and we, you know, I believe, given time, that was going to be a massively successful club. And unfortunately, I was at this crossroads: do I go to Spain and take this opportunity to improve myself, to develop myself, or do I stick with Middlesbrough that I feared it wouldn't be the same without me? I hoped, you know, other people would take it on, but that didn't happen. I just had this crossroads, and to be honest, I'd always wanted to go to Spain. I knew in England I wasn't going to develop as much as I could. So, yeah, in the end, I took this opportunity, even though I went from coaching a senior team in the top division in the country to coaching, you know, at the bottom, a junior team in the bottom league of a regional division. So, you know, I had to have this sort of attitude that, yeah, I need to go and learn. I need to go and start from the bottom and not think that I'm ahead of myself. And so, yeah, I took this opportunity because I wanted to learn Spanish. I'd always wanted to live abroad, and, you know, this was a good time to do it. I was 29 at the time. I had no family ties, no kids, no mortgage, nothing like that. So you know, I could. I will confess that I'd met a Spanish girl, and we'd been, you know, seeing each other a little bit in the months leading up to it, so, you know, that helped the move as well.
The language
move. And I wanted to learn Spanish, but there's a saying in Spain that they say you only learn a language in the cot or in the bed. So, you know, either your mother tongue or because you fall in love. So, yeah. You know, that gave me motivation to learn the language, but also because futsal's just the amount of material that is in Spanish. And the amount of courses it is in Spanish, and the amount of coaches that I could then communicate with, it's a no-brainer to learn that language for me. So, Spain was a massive, massive experience in my life, massive change for me, life experience, coaching experience, you know, everything. It's what got me the future opportunities. So it was a big investment because, you know, I basically had to pay my own way to go and live in Spain, and I had to go and teach English in schools and things like that. So you know, it wasn't a professional job. It wasn't, Damon, come over, we'll give you all the money you need, give you accommodation. No, I had to go in and work and study and pay my own way and just to get those opportunities. And no, in terms of futsal, I learned so much. I had a year as assistant coach in my final year in Spain, and that was, in terms of learning, the best year of my life. So I'd just done my UEFA, so I was putting a lot of that into practice and, you know, using stuff I learned and learning from a very good coach in a professional club. So that final year in Spain was, you know, invaluable for me to boost my CV, but also, you know, just improve my life and my experiences.
And talking about the A-licence, the futsal A-licence, you know, it must be, you know, really a very high, like really high in the preference, you know, of when you completed, you won championships, you moved to Spain, you're completing your A-licence, but you said it was only one of two of you in the England at that point. How did you try and, you know, what were the difficulties on the A-licence, you know, for the kind of futsal? Because, as I said, doing the UEFA A-licence, the kind of football one, is very difficult, but I wonder how, was it really demanding the futsal side of it? And also working with the other person who was doing the A-licence, you know, the other English person, did you bond with that person to try and create more, you know, relationships?
So the A-licence in Spain in futsal, it's a very different pathway. Now, UEFA B in Spain is the entry-level coach, not the entry-level. You can do it without any of the courses. They recommend doing the monitor course, which is perhaps equivalent to the English, maybe Scottish, so I don't know, the English level one and level two.
Yeah.
So I think that comes before UEFA B, right, in England. So UEFA B is almost the entry-level course. So, you know, as long as you've got some experience coaching, if you've done the monitor course, even better. So that's your first port of call to get into coaching, really. It's not the same as the UK, where there's an application process. I mean, you do have to apply, you do have to get accepted onto it, but it seems to be quite easy to get on. You know, as long as you pay your fees, as long as you've got some coaching experience, you don't need, you know, any special connections or anything like that to get on the course. And it's relatively cheap. It's €1,200, I think, I paid for the UEFA B.
Yeah.
And it felt like, I've done a few courses in the UK as well, and the difference felt like the Spanish course was a course where you go there to learn, you go there to develop yourself and then take an exam and come away. It feels like a degree almost, a bit shorter than a degree, but it felt like a degree. So UEFA B, first year, UEFA A, second year sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas in England, I feel like the licences are more of they're more like the driving licence. So you need to get to a level before you go on that course. And then you go on that course to show that you are that level to get the license. I think that's the difference between the courses, you know, just sort of very basically. I'm not saying you don't learn stuff on the English course. I'm not saying the Spanish course is not a license. That, you know, they both, at the end of the day, they give you the same qualification. But I just feel the Spanish one, they give you more content. They give you more information to become everything you need to pass the license at the end of it, whereas I think England's just a bit different.
Yeah.
And both countries are well known for the coach education, so I'm not saying there's one right or one wrong, but I really enjoyed it. I learned so much on both the UEFA B, UEFA A. They were intense, so they were summer long courses. I think 6 weeks for UEFA B, 7 weeks for UEFA A. 5-6 hours per evening plus. So 10 hours on a Saturday for all those weeks. And you know, obviously the hardest part of it for me was the language.
Yeah.
I was quite good in Spanish at that point, but you know, I still didn't understand as much as a native. But yeah, once I got over the language barrier, And there was also the other barrier of, well, I'm an English guy that doesn't know anything about futsal. So there's a bit of prejudice there against English coaches. I think even Gary Neville said it. I think there's some sort of, or maybe David Moyes, I can't remember. There's the English coaches who don't have a good reputation abroad, certainly in Spain.
It was Gary Neville, because he talked about that when he was at Valencia, you know, and it was very interesting, you know, the having that way of thinking, you know, I can go in into a top class team, you know, but I want to have this, and this. But the way he kind of reflected was the best way to do it is actually just do a short term vision in the moment and then work on the long term vision at the end, you know. But you've got maybe 3-4 months to work. You know, you don't need to learn the language to an extent. Just learn phrases that are going to help, you know, get that message across. Because, you know, I'm learning Spanish in the moment too, and it's the phrases are coming to my head. But I don't feel that comfortable talking, you know, with a conversation. But if I get 4 or 5 phrases, then that conversation might not be the best. It's a bit broken, but people, you can understand, oh, I meant this and I meant that. And I think if you make an effort, like as you said, going to Spain, people, I think, or France or Germany or any other country that doesn't speak English, that kind of thing, if you make an effort to speak their native tongue, they will help you out a bit more. You know what I mean? Like I know in different courses, you know, that if you speak, you try and help, you know, like explain things, and you're not getting it 100%. But if the coach educator or the tutors or the players, they will try and help you out more. But if you stand there and try and speak to them in English and they don't understand it and you're getting frustrated, they're going to get frustrated too, which is the kind of, you know, double-sided barrel. But as I said, it's something interesting in the kind of futsal world.
And obviously, speaking their language, I couldn't have done the course without knowing the language. It was a prerequisite. You had to be fluent in the language enough to understand the course. So, and the tactical stuff, I didn't have as much tactical knowledge as some of the coaches on my course that had grown up playing futsal and been taught for the last 10, 15 years from their coaches. You know, so I was behind in that sense. And you know, I still feel like I'm playing catch up with Spanish people. I'm building up my own sort of philosophy, my own learning, my own understanding of it. I think having not been a football coach has been an advantage to me.
Yeah,
I think that not having the sort of the preconception of how to coach football really helped me sort of be a sponge to futsal and not sort of go in and think I already know things. So you know, you've got to be open, you've got to be sort of willing to learn and sort of humble, and you know, that got me through the courses. The tutors were amazing, you know, they helped me. I always showed sort of willing and asking questions and that sort of thing, and yeah, so the challenge was the language, the culture, you know, the content of the course was brilliant. They give you everything you need to pass it. You know, like I said, it's more like a university degree than you need to do your own work. You do need to do your own sort of study and stuff, but
yeah,
they prepare you to pass the course. The biggest challenges were the sort of the culture and the language initially,
and as you said, that having that mindset, you know, that growth mindset to learn something new, you know, this kind of the last couple of questions on your journey, and it's like, from there, you know, you went to Tranmere, then to Malta, now in Malaysia. Can you just tell us the kind of journey for the last maybe 3-4 years of how you've kind of, you know, moved to different countries to try and develop yourself, you know, as a coach, but also, you know, as you said, every kind of coaching job I get better at, you know, I get more comfortable, but I can actually work from the bottom upwards. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us the kind of journey from the kind of coaching side, but also your mindset of going to different countries for the last, maybe going back to Tranmere, then go to Malta, and then in Malaysia, and then tell us maybe about the kind of Malaysian kind of Premier League you're working in.
Yeah, so I think it's always important that you've got to be open, you've got to be humble again. Yeah, I've used that before, but you've got to put yourself out there. So if you do want to have these opportunities come up, then, you know, for me, it's not about money. It's about life experiences and, you know, experiencing different cultures and countries rather than, you know, and futsal in different places. Although every job I've gone into, I go in with a long-term mindset. Yeah. And we know in football, futsal, in the sports industry, jobs can be 1 year, 2 year, you know.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to go into every job with a long-term plan. Leave whatever happens, you know, the finances might not be good and you lose your job, or restructuring, you might lose your job. But if you go in and plan for the long term, I think you'll leave more of a mark on that club. And you know, if you go into a club, I think that's a good mindset to have, rather than just going in, doing a job, winning some games, and then leaving. Now, what good's that to anybody, really? Tranmere came about through a Twitter conversation, actually, with Nicola Palios. And she, I think, then saw my Twitter profile, which I'd edited it to make it, you know, sell myself.
Yeah.
You know, and then I had this conversation with Nicola on Twitter, just about other things, and then she got in touch saying, would you be interested in coming to do this, you know, heading up our futsal section where we want to do this, and she rang me the next day, we had half an hour conversation, and she sold it to me. You know, it was a dream come true, because that was my first paid full-time role in futsal. You know, it was a hard one to take, a hard decision to make, because I was living in Spain, I was happy. You know, I was with my girlfriend at the time, and, you know, teaching English, she was working at a hotel. It was a nice life in Spain. But I also knew that if I want to be successful, I'd have to leave Spain at some point, because to get to the top in Spain, yeah, maybe I could, but I think doing that from Spain is going to take a lot longer than it would take if I go abroad and make a name for myself, and then maybe I get the chance to come back to Spain. I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens, but it was a tough decision to make to go back to England, but, you know, I had to make it. I went there, we built something, we built a club really fast, and we grew it from zero kids to 130-140 kids in sort of the 18 months that I was there. I say we because I had a good assistant, Matt Fijos, who's still working in the UK. You know, we built this community, we built this family. We had kids that were dedicating themselves to futsal just in the space of 12 months of doing it. They were choosing it over football, which it's not my aim to take kids away from football, but to put something on that, if they like it, then it's there for them. You know, so at Tranmere, I was there for life. It was, you know, right, I'm going to settle there. That was sort of my mindset at the time, but, you know, things didn't work out. Financial restructure of the club, or changing ideas, changing whatever, and my role were given to somebody else as a sort of merging the role, I guess, to save money. And then that's when I got a call from Malta, and it was literally 2 days after I'd announced that I was leaving Tranmere that they got in touch. They wanted to do something similar. And that's the first time I felt like, I don't want to say made it, because I still haven't made it. I don't think I'll ever make it, but at that point I thought, actually, I'm in a position now where I can get jobs in different countries and different clubs, and you know, it was a nice feeling, because it had taken me sort of 12 years of voluntary work and learning and studying and sacrifices and investment to get to this point. So, you know, it's a nice feeling that all that effort you've put into has sort of paid off. I know Malta was a beautiful experience. It was my first job abroad. In terms, Spain wasn't a job, it was my sort of study, my investment. So to go and live abroad and get paid for it, it was a beautiful experience. It was a semi-serious club. It was a very small country, so it had its challenges. And the first year there, I loved it. I absolutely loved that experience in the first year. Unfortunately, second year, the club had some problems again with finances. I think they lost a sponsor, which sort of messed up our preparations. And then at the start of the second season, I lost 6 out of 7 games, which ultimately, as a head coach, that's your head's on the line for that sort of thing. So,
the results business at the end of the day, you know, like, and I think, as you said, like, working at a professional level or a top level, maybe in kind of senior level, you're basically, if you don't deliver the results, you're going to, as I said, get fired or, you know, get let go. But I think there's a bit more time in the youth game because you can develop the players a bit more and it's not as much results based.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, that depends on what the club is and who's running and all that. But again, I think working with, you know, different variety of players, you can always see the, you know, the different age groups, you know, and that age related. You know, the age-related, you know, relative effect. You know, like, you could someone who's 11, you know, another 11-year-old, and then 2 years later, the one who was the smallest 11-year-old was the tallest, you know, and the other 11-year-old still the same. But, sorry, that was just me interrupting there, sorry.
No, that's cool. So, in Malta, again, it was a step up from Tranmere in that the senior team was semi-professional rather than amateur. I had some academy work there as well, which it was part of my role to introduce futsal in the football academy, which, again, we had sort of barriers to doing that. I'm waiting to find a place where I can really go and put my vision in. I'm thinking Malaysia's that place, but we'll see how the sort of plans go in the next few months. So Malta was brilliant. I love the island. It was a good lifestyle. At Tranmere, I was working 60, 70 hours a week. It cost me a relationship. It cost me, you know, part of my business, the summer camps that I run, they took a hit. So I literally put everything into the job at Tranmere. And unfortunately, it wasn't enough to give me a longer stint there. But Malta was a big change. And, you know, it was the opposite of that. It was a lot of working from home, beautiful weather, sweet. You know, working from home could be working at a cafe by the beach, that sort of thing. So, it was a massive change in lifestyle, and I loved it. I got myself fit, I got myself healthy, looked after myself mentally as well. I made sure I was looking after myself in all sorts of ways, and obviously gaining that experience and trying to implement something that I'd learned in the last, what I'd done in Tranmere and what I'd learned in Spain. So. Yeah, Malta was a great experience, and I feel like it's unfinished business, but I also feel like the country's it's going to struggle to ever be a sort of a futsal power because of the size of it. Malta was a good experience, but as I left there, again, it was within a week, I think, I was talking to a club in Malaysia, and the timing was just perfect because they were looking for a new coach. I'd just left my job at Malta, I'm going to Malaysia. It took a while. It took a lot of time to sort of get the details and get the contract. And I had to actually fly out on my own back. Things were just taking time. And I think the manager here was a bit unsure of whether they should hire a foreign coach.
Yeah.
Certainly one that's, I'm not proven at all. My last job, I got sacked for losing 6 games out of 7. So, it's a risk for the club. So I thought, right, I'm just going to go and book a one-way flight.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and see the club, see the management, show them that I'm serious, meet them, let them get to know me, and so I had the offer. I had the sort of. I knew they wanted to hire me, but. Obviously, nothing was signed, so I flew over. Again, without the ties, without the family ties, without the mortgage, I'm quite a flexible person, and I thought, right, I'm just going to go for it. And worst case scenario, they don't hire me, I go and travel for a bit, and then come back in the summer for next season to find something. So it was, for me, it was a no-brainer. It was a win-win situation. And again, it was a step up. Now I've got a full professional team, a full professional backroom staff, a club that's well known in Malaysia. Here it's another level. Unfortunately, we've not played any matches in front of the fans yet because of lockdown. So one of the things I always wanted to experience at Middlesbrough with the fans and having a full house and being a professional coach, I am that now, but I haven't really experienced it to the fullest. So, we're just in this situation now. The league's just been cancelled today. Just waiting for news, I guess, waiting for things to get back to normal and then, I can really get my teeth into this job.
Brilliant. And kind of final couple of questions, because I've taken 40 minutes of your time. So,
don't worry about my time. I've literally got no plans.
I will. My wife's looking at me, thinking, "Come on, we'll go for a walk soon." But the coach education part, I was interested in because you talked about Mondial Futsal and then the Futsal Camp UK, and I'm just wondering how you influenced kids, because futsal does take a bit of convincing because, everyone has a hero, like the Messi, the Ronaldo. But in futsal, a lot of the people aren't sure who they are. How do you try, through your coach education, to build that, your brand, so therefore that you have that mindset of, I may get 5 kids in, or I may get 10 kids in, or I may get 1, But it depends. That one experience might help a kid, think, I want to be a futsal player, it may be a professional or just recreational, but again, through the coach education, I'm just wondering if you could talk about that.
Sorry, how do you mean through the coach education or?
So through your coach education, so you've ran, camps and different futsal kind of leagues. I'm just wondering how you try to implement your style working with the players in the camps?
Yeah, so what I did in Nantes, I've done a few sort of presentations or seminars sort of things for the coaches. But I think the big thing to, I think the question is more about how to convince the kids and give them something to aspire to sort of thing. I think it's massive that they need an idol. They need a role model. And I think in England, we don't really have that for the kids at the minute, not on a wide scale. And what I found, though, at Tranmere, we had the kids mingling with the senior players, and the senior players sort of became mini celebrities, certainly to the academy kids that we were within the same club. I think that's important. If you've got something for the kids to aspire to, they don't think about the money. They don't think they want to be a football player to earn money. They think about playing football at the top level. And I found a lot of the kids were starting to get in their mindset that I want to be a futsal player. And that was a big moment for me to hear kids and the parents saying, "Oh, he loves futsal, he wants to be a futsal player." And you need that senior team, you need that aspirational thing for them. If you just run a futsal academy, just doing coaching for 12, 13-year-olds, without having that pathway for them to go on to be a senior player for your club, then I think it loses something, because we don't have superstars yet in England. We don't have players that they can aspire to outside of your own setting. So you need to do it all yourself. You need to make the superstars within your own community. You need to sell the dream to the kids. And the best thing we can sell, I think, to kids at the minute is the fact that they could go on to play for England. And I think that needs to be promoted more. That needs to be, done more centrally from the FA, that futsal is a valid pathway. And we've got a young lad called Liam Palfreyman who's playing professionally abroad at the moment. And I think the FA needs to do as much as they can to make Liam this superstar star, this person that kids can aspire to be, and following his journey. And you know, that hopefully will get more kids taking up futsal because they want to be like Liam. They want to go and play in top leagues and be a, let's say, famous futsal player, and they can be. And you know, there's kids now that could go on to become worldwide superstars if they get the right training and dedicate themselves to futsal. And it's always going to help the football.
Yeah,
futsal will always do that. I'm of the opinion that you need to do futsal properly for it to become a big help for football. But you know, I think if kids get that aspirational person, the role model, to go on to do futsal, then I think it'll just make it a lot easier to get them in the first place. Once they're in, they love the game. Once anyone's played the game, they love it. It's so much fun, and so it's just getting them in through the door. And I think that needs to come from the FA, from the top, good marketing, but also the local hotspots, so the local clubs, the Manchester, the York, the Birmingham, the Helvetia. These clubs need to be selling it to these kids to get them in, and it seems to be working. We seem to be going in that direction.
Yeah, definitely. And through, I know at this time, a lot of coaches are kind of scratching their heads, or they're overloading or underloading with information. And mental health is a big thing at the moment. And when, as I said, I was doing my research, and you do a lot of work, or you try to. I know your family's involved in the kind of suicide, awareness and prevention. I was just wondering if you want to, talk about that for a few minutes.
Yes. So my sister set up this. I'm gonna say charity. It's not officially registered as a charity at the minute. I think it's a community interest company just to begin with.
Okay.
But by all intents and purposes, it's the charity. We want it to be a charity. So she set up Suicide Awareness and Prevention UK. After my stepdad killed himself, it's 2016 now, so 4 years ago. She set it up because I think it affected her. She's the one that found him, and it affected her. But I think more than affecting her, it made her think that there's people out there that feel this way, that want to stay alive, and she wanted to do something about it. And so she set this charity up. Now, obviously, being my sister, it's something that I'm interested in, and being obviously my stepdad, something that it touches me as well, that there's people out there that feel this way and have this sort of negative outlook on life. And I've done some volunteering with the Facebook page, and talking to some people that have been feeling down, and it's really sad. It really pains me that there's people out there that can't see the positives in life. And I'm naturally a positive person. I've had this sort of brief period where, because I've always been happy, always been positive, and just as I moved to Malta, I had this sort of sad feeling for a certain period of time, and I just found myself crying at weird times, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't understand why I was feeling this way, and it was like everything was just bad, and I couldn't see any positives. Even though my logical part of me was thinking, I should be so happy, I'm in a beautiful place, dream job. But I wasn't. There was something wrong with me. And it turns out, because I didn't do any tests or anything, but I'd recently gone vegan. So my diet affected the chemicals in the brain or whatever, and it made me feel like that. And that opened my eyes up to depression. I'm not going to say I was depressed, because I wasn't. I was lacking, I think, some vitamin B12, which affected me. But it opened my eyes to depression, because maybe before that I was guilty of thinking you can snap out of it. And I know it's not that simple. I know you can't. And having experienced that brief period of my life where I couldn't control the feelings, that made me understand that actually people with depression do have a chemical imbalance in the brain, and they can't just snap out of it. And you know, it's not easy for them, and you know, I'm not an expert, but that's just my experience, and yeah, it makes me sad that there's people that feel like this, and yeah, we try and help people and try and, you know, share positivity, and you know, they do a lot of good work. They've got a lot of volunteers now that sort of run weekly. I think one of them is called sort of Snapchat, where people can drop in live and go and chat to people and get advice and help. And, you know, it's just a way of spreading positivity that my sister wants to do something about, you know, people that feel this way. And, you know, I think it's important to talk. What helped me, and again, I wasn't a bad case. I was just feeling a bit down, and what really helped me was talking about it.
Yeah.
Because if I didn't talk about it, I was feeling down, I was sad, and you know, a lot of the time I probably wouldn't talk about it. But this time I talked about it. I spoke to one of my best friends, and she asked if I was okay, and I was like, "Well, no, I'm not. I don't know what's up." And the fact that I talked about it, she then told me about, she'd had a bit of an episode recently, and it was her diet.
Yeah.
So she looked up some stuff for me and said, maybe it's your diet, because I had changed to being vegan recently. And she found a link to vitamin B12 and saying one of the effects of deficiency is depression. And the fact that I talked about it, like I said, I wasn't suicidal. I wasn't properly depressed. I was just feeling, you know, I was a bit down.
Yeah.
So I don't want to take anything away from people that really are depressed, but talking about it helped me get the solution that I needed, and that was simply taking vitamin B12 supplements. One day later, I took them and I was absolutely fine again.
Yeah.
So it might be that someone's feeling depressed and they just need to talk about it, and someone's going to help them with something that they need. I don't know what it might be. Could be medication, could be a change in the diet, could be changing something. And yeah, it really is important to talk about it, you know, especially maybe people in sport, maybe men in sport. It's not something we can talk about, or it's not something we feel we can talk about as openly as some other people, I don't think.
Yeah, and as I said, if you ever need anything, you know, like at the Curve, we're always here to help. If you know, if you want to talk, we're always here. You know, like anyone else in the sporting world, you know, it's the best thing to do. It's just have that 5-minute chat or that hour chat could see, you know, change someone's life. So it's that kind of, as I said, it's always good to chat to someone, and if it's just 2 minutes, just to get that reassurance. But as the kind of final question, you know, we always end with is, what does mindset mean to you?
Mindset is the way you see things, and the way, you know, my life would have taken a totally different trajectory if I didn't have the mindset of always wanting to improve myself and always wanting to learn. And I think one of my biggest sort of abilities is being able to draw a line under what I've done previously. And I think if you have that mindset where you've never quite made it, or you've never made it, because I don't think I ever will make it, as long as you've got that ability to know that you can keep learning, then, you know, you're going to keep growing and you're going to keep improving and being positive. And yeah, for me, that's, I think that's quite a big, you know, my mindset, that is my mindset. So, you know, maybe for me, that is mindset.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers the question very well, but,
no,
but yeah, putting a line under what you've learned, what you know, and being willing to start again is so important, especially for coaches.
Perfect. Okay. Thanks again, Damon.
No, thank you, Laurie. It's been a pleasure.